Happy Shabbat, everyone. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. My pleasure to be with you. Looks like we have Larry and Kirk with us. How are you guys?
Just fine. How's Larry?
Well, I've been better.
Uh-oh.
I had the shakes again last night, but you know what? It is what it is. I'll get over it. I'm taking some antibiotics now, so we'll see.
So it's been a crippling bug.
Yeah, it really has. Yeah.
Well,
for one of those where, you know, you feel like you ever have, remember being a kid when 24 hours felt like a week?
Yeah.
Because you were sick. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's
yeah, when I got malaria, I remember the first 8 hours of malaria felt like a lifetime. And,
I can believe that.
Yeah.
I can believe that.
Hey, you know that malaria right now is on a huge increase? You know, it talks about pestilence being a one of the conditions for the last days and it being a birth bag where it becomes far more prevalent and more extreme. And malaria is increasing to the point now where there's a million cases now, new cases a year. And it's devastating Africa.
Well, they say that the mosquito is the deadliest animal. Kills 2 million people a year. 2 million.
Yeah.
2 million.
Yeah. You know, I have a more open-minded view of pestilence than I had even 6 months ago. 6 months ago, I would have looked at the conditions that Yosha on the Mount of Olives said were going to be like birth pangs for the tribulation. And, you know, you have wars, world war, and we're on the precipice of that. And you have an increase of terror. Of course, we're certainly witnessing that. And he mentions famine, and he mentions megaseismos, which is everything from increased earthquakes to hurricanes to tsunamis, of which we're experiencing all of those things. But he mentions pestilence.
And, of course, typically you would think in terms of, you know, diseases, right?
Right. This kind of stuff you would treat with antibiotic or other kind of medications. But what is the deadliest, most crippling disease that man has ever encountered?
Christianity.
Yeah.
Islam. Religion.
Yeah. Well, Christianity is the right answer. First and foremost, the single most deadly disease man's ever encountered. And second only to it would be Islam. So, yeah, indeed, we're talking about a deadly pathogen.
Of course, secular humanism is in that mix, too,
right,
because
right. That
is flat out a religion. So we're talking about billions in each case, I think.
Yeah, you know, in the case of socialist secular humanism, I got new appreciation for the exactness of Yahweh's prophecies. You know, we've been considering Yashaya 28. Isaiah 28, and it is condemning of falling Christianity. But as it, in the preamble, Yahweh talks about Ephraim, which is institutionalized religion and institutionalized politics, national politics, institutionalized religion, broad-based, widespread, all perpetrated in the name of the Lord, Satan, which is in opposition to Yahweh. And twice in that opening stanza, Yahweh says that they're intoxicated, which means their judgment is impaired. And when you think of the spirituality associated with socialist secular humanism, you know, that, oh, they're a spiritual person. And then you think about how political correctness exists primarily to impair people's judgment, to make it extremely difficult to exercise good judgment for fear that you'll be ostracized. So when he talks about being intoxicated, inebriated, having one's judgment impaired, I think he is talking to a large degree about both Christianity and socialist secular humanism. And there's never been a human doctrine that has been as crippling to people's judgment as socialist secular humanism.
I think that is true. Obviously, they lack complete judgment. I've debated them. I've shown them the dimensions of the ark. I've shown them the six days equating out to, you know, 14.7 billion years. You know, I've done all these things.
The birth
and
of the bacteria.
I've even shown them the prediction of a crucifixion. And right. One of them said, oh, they had crucifixion, man. Yeah, I said, with ropes. But not with nails. And further, we had no idea how crucifixion killed. This just explains it all. How do you figure that? They don't answer. They don't.
And by the way, Larry, just as a not thought that it would make any difference with a socialist secular humanist, but the Psalm 22 and 88 that define and describe crucifixion, they were written 1000 BCE. Do you know when the Assyrians invented crucifixion with ropes?
No, I don't. Probably 500 BCE or something.
That is correct, 500 BCE. And then the Romans went from ropes to nails. And by the way, the Romans were principally ropes, but they also used nails. But the Roman nail crucifixion didn't begin until right around 100 BCE to 150 BCE in that range. So
we're talking 900 years before it was invented. It was described, and beyond being described, it described how it killed, which is something we wouldn't have known until recently.
Right. Yeah, I don't know when Zechariah was written, but I would guess Zechariah is probably around 5.
Zechariah was written in 503 B.C.
Okay, I was going to guess about 500 B.C.E., so I was 3 years off there. It says they will look upon me whom they have pierced. Yes. So
straight up.
So straight up. And so at 500 BCE, that was 400 years before crucifixion with nails existed. In Dode's account of crucifixion and the way that it kills was 500 years in advance of crucifixion by rope. 500 years is a long time to predict something with scientific accuracy. And actually, the prediction is in Psalm 22 and in particular, and it's medical analysis of the means that crucifixion uses to kill.
That's astonishing.
You know when that can be known to us?
Let me give it 100 years, maybe? What?
Yeah, within the last 50 to 75 years.
Okay, yeah,
so
that would make sense.
It was 3,000 years ahead of its time.
Yeah, I know. And yet none of this makes any sense to any of these boobs from what I
can tell.
Matter of fact, it doesn't make sense to a rabbinic Jew. It doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
They go, run in a circle, and Hashem never said any of this, and run and bolt, and you're sitting there going, what is wrong with you?
Right, man there. Came up with the term Big Bang to deal with the transition from steady-state universe, which 90% of scientists embraced, to an expanding universe that therefore had to have been created.
The noise is from the gamma rays, isn't it?
With Hubble's discovery of the redshift. With the redshift shows that light stars are moving away from us. If they're moving away from us in all directions, that means the universe
expanding.
Is expanding. And if the universe is expanding, then that means that at one point it was all together and there was a Big Bang. So that concept was first articulated about 1950. And the Yahweh used the term Big Bang and specifically an expanding universe that was created, and he shared that with Moshe, 1450 BCE. So 3,400 years before we coined the term and came to understand it.
Now,
3,400 years before we understood relativity, and that a witness at creation would have experienced exactly 6 24-hour days, making the universe, from our perspective, looking back on our planet, 15 billion years old. That to have that written down, using the Hebrew word for relative, Asher, over and over again, 3,400 years before we figured it out.
Yeah, he used relativity four times. I mean,
right.
Relative to this, relative to that. You know, you're talking about Psalm 19:1-2 when you're talking about the, you know, expansion of the universe. It says the heavens quantify the unit of measure exactly and accurately, the manifestation of power of God. It's spreading out in expanse, making conspicuous his handiwork. Day unto day pours out answers, and night unto night reveals knowledge. It couldn't be any clearer. It's expanding. And then he goes in Psalm 94, he says, indeed, because 1,000 years in your sight and perspective are like a day, the same as yesterday when it passes by a perspective observer in the night. So depending on where you're at in this continuum of space-time, time passes differently. That's what relativity is.
That's right.
Period. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's stunningly brilliant. Here, this morning, we're talking, Kirk and I are going over the 28th chapter of Yeshayah. And here's Yahweh talking about Ephraim, which would be the United States, Europe. It's the West.
Yeah, sure.
Today.
All the dead guys. Yeah.
And he's talking about condemning the leaders. And he specifically says that those leaders, Merkel in Germany, that those leaders are going to be trampled underfoot by militants. The very militants.
The very militants they're bringing into their country.
Yeah, I was just going to trample them underfoot. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And then, which is just so funny, because everyone's using this tsunami of militants, or tsunami of Muslims, or tsunami of refugees, and this tidal wave of humanity. And Yahweh used exactly the same term. He just says, "Yeah, I'm going to wash them all away with a tidal wave, with a mighty storm. I'm just going to cleanse all of it." And you know, here in Yeshayah 28, we have found affirmation for what I don't know if I ever had proof of it. It's just one of the things that I gravitated to that was so obvious, at least to me. I mean, a lot of things haven't been obvious. It's taken a long time to figure them out. But it just
and by the way, do you mind shooting that over to me in an email along with the Hosha, with the plague of death? I really want that. I want to add it to a note that I've already got on call,
okay.
The plague of death.
Okay, yeah. I'll do that. What was really interesting, I haven't translated all of Yasha the 28, and I've got considerable more work. I'm going to go back and translate Hosha, because Hosha also speaks of Paul being the plague of death, and how Yahweh, in the middle of that whole condemnation of Ephraim, you know, where he speaks of, as you know, in the same chapter in Ephraim, where he defines Ephraim as a religious entity in league with Satan, that claims its credibility based upon its association with Abraham. That's how it claims its identity and association, but yet in league with Satan, became adversarial and religious. That in that same chapter, where it's defined Ephraim as Christianity, if you will. It says that, okay, Shaul, where is your plague of death? You know, Shaul, you know, where is all of this that you put into place? I've redeemed them. I have given them life. And so Yahweh is telling us in the last days that he's going to do what he has done for us, which is to liberate individuals from the plague of Christianity, which is us. What I was going to say is the thing that seems so obvious to me, and in the 28th chapter of Yeshayah, we found affirmation of it, is that the 6+1 plan that Yahweh articulated in creation and with the Shabbat and with the Mikra, that what he is saying is that we started in Eden, and life was perfect. There was no religion. There was no politics. There were no armies. There were no police. There was just Yahweh and us and a beautiful environment. And it struck me that the whole 6+1 plan is that we're estranged from that paradise, that religion-free zone with Yahweh, this camping out with Yahweh and exploring life with him for 6 days, 6,000 years. And at the end of that time, as we approach Sukkah, camping out with God, the seventh day, Yahweh is not only going to camp out here on earth, he is going to cleanse the entire earth of all vestiges of religion and politics, including the host of religion and politics, polluted individuals, and is going to wipe away all of that and transform the entire earth into the conditions experienced in the Garden of Eden. And the 28th chapter of Yeshayah says exactly that. Now, those kind of affirmations mean a lot to me, because it was one of the things where I could never cite a passage that said, this is what God's going to do. But it was so obvious that was his plan. And now in Yeshayah, we're reading specifically that is his plan. You know, the whole discussion begins here. I'm going to actually start. Well, I'll just read from the beginning of Yeshayah 28, and then we'll talk about it, because it transitions into Teruah, and we can then go into Yahweh's presentation of Teruah.
So we're going right with 28:1 with the
Woe to the presumptuous, the arrogant, and the conceited leaders, the crown of the inebriated of Ephraim. So these are those whose judgment has been impaired by the leadership of institutional politics and religion. And that,
in fact, in Chabot, that's what he says. He calls it intoxicated. That Paul's got them intoxicated. Sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and intoxicated, all that means is that intoxication conveys two things. One is, and the principal thing is, your judgment is impaired. And number two is that you're filled with the wrong spirit.
That's right.
Those are the two thoughts when you read intoxication. So then he gets symbolic. So then the flowers, beauty, its desirability and honor, foolishly fades away. Its attractiveness, which was beneficially by way of relationship, first and foremost a valley of olives, will be overcome and struck down with intoxication, with inebriation. Very important teaching here, because he's speaking of a plant that is rooted, that whose attractive reproductive capability has been destroyed. So it can't breed covenant's children, and it's no longer desirable or attractive to God. And yet it's just the flower that's faded. It's planted in the right place. Nothing wrong with the bush. It's the flower which is faded. And that's symbolic both of rabbinic Judaism, Christianity, and to a degree Islam, all three of which claim to be rooted in Abraham. Nothing wrong with Abraham. Nothing wrong with being rooted in Abraham. It's just that they've all, through an intoxicated brew of demonic rhetoric, have followed the inebriating speech of religious leaders away from the simple truth of that covenant relationship. And so they are no longer a conduit for olives and all the things that are associated with olives, the longest-lived tree, enlightenment, healing, nourishment, and the like. So then he reemphasizes something that we have known. I think as a group, this is, if there's anything that is central to what we share in common, this and what Yahweh says next is central to us. Pay attention, which is henna, which means stand up, look up, and pay attention. One is restored by being uncompromising and also steadfast, adamant, and inflexible. They approach Yahweh. So it's God saying there's not a lot of different ways. I don't grade on the curve. No gray areas. All religions don't lead to me.
Yeah. It's the Rith or a Zob. No fence setters here. I think Dode said he absolutely hated the fence setters.
Yeah. It's clear. There's one way. Be steadfast. Be adamant. Don't pretend that God's going to accept anything else. Like somebody says, well, he knows what I'm calling. He knows his name. He knows I'm referring to him when I call him Jesus. He knows that I'm talking to him when I call him Lord. No, he knows who you're talking to when you use Lord. And he doesn't have a clue who you're talking to when you're saying Jesus. Be steadfast. Be adamant. Yahweh's way or the highway. Pay attention. One is restored by being uncompromising. They are the ones that approach Yahweh. Then he says, in a manner similar to a downpour, to an outpouring of water with hail, a storm which separates and divides, like a flood of waters, a great and powerful flood, he will wash away. Just as the Muslims are flooding into the United States and to Europe, and will flood into Israel just 11 years from now. Yahweh is going to do what they are doing. He's going to wipe them away. He's going to wash away all vestiges of religion and politics. I mean, he's speaking of everything that can be considered intoxicating. So it's religion and politics. He's going to wash it away. And the reason he's going to wash it away is to establish Eden-like conditions on earth. He will establish a home for restoration and rest, settling down spiritually to approach the land with his hand. So the land, which has always been a metaphor for camping out with God, for living with him in his home, he is going to cleanse everything as he approaches the land. He's going to do so with his own hand. And by getting rid of religion, he's going to turn the earth back into the conditions experienced in the Garden of Eden.
Do y'all know what the Sahar, you know, where the third word in there where it says a deluge? You know what one of the other early meanings is? It says a rainstorm or a storm of persons of rage that causes one to fear. Does that describe the Muslims coming in?
Sure does.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's the Muslims that are going to follow, and here's why. Most of those are secular Muslims, the ones certainly I've been seeing run into Hungary. They're secular. They're really secular. By the way they dress.
Well, not a huge percentage of the women are wearing their burqas.
Not the full-on
burqa, but certainly wearing the headscarves.
The hijab.
And they're acting like Muslims, man. They're enraged.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
The pictures I saw, they looked Western. I know they're running from ISIS, you know, and that bunch, which are killing them.
Yeah. You know? Be careful. Be careful there, though. You know, if you're a Shia Muslim living in an area that the Islamic State has dominion over, you are going to try to flee the Islamic State. But, you know, sure. if you're a Sunni Muslim living in Baghdad, for example, you know, you're being tormented by the Shia Muslims. So, you know, it depends on where you are. If you're in an area controlled by Hezbollah, then you're going to be fleeing the Shia Muslims. And then look at Libya.
Well,
Libya is producing almost as many refugees as Syria. And
brother
Syria,
will be against his brother.
Right. Brother will be against the brother. It's a religion that never gave anyone a reason to live, only a reason to die.
That's the truth too.
And so it's like the Somalis, the million Somalis that were brought into the United States. You know, after they killed us with Black Hawk Down, and they proved impossible to help, we brought a million of them here. And they just recently of them, and all of those under the age of 30, the vast preponderance, wanted to go back to Somalia and play jihad.
Oh yeah, well they're Africans. You know you get from Egypt right on down. They're all like that. I mean, I promise you that. I know that. And I was around a lot of Somalis in Omaha. I'm not sure if you're aware, but they did a rather large dump there. And yeah, they were odd people. You know, they had their chief. And he'd always be some guy with a robe and a religious hat on, and they were out doing animal sacrifices in their backyards and so forth. Very, very, very strange.
Yeah. Yeah. The only quasi-secular Muslims, which would be hypocrites according to the Quran, that I think you're likely to see is not so much Syria, but there are some in the vestiges of Persia, therefore in Iran. Most of those have already left, and a huge percentage are now living in West L.A. and Beverly Hills. But there are a significant number of Persians who actually integrated into Western society once they left an Islamic Iran. And most of them fled because they didn't want to be under the Ayatollah. And there are, at least there were, I'm not so sure there are anymore, but there was a period of time under the more secular dictators like Musharraf that there were Pakistanis educated in the West that were capable of integrating into Western society. And there was
which
a
no longer
time,
appears to be true at all. And most of the Iranians, even in Iran, and believe me, I have contact with over 200 of them regularly.
Right.
They just hate Islam. Yeah. They're embarrassed of it. You know, they're
right.
Embarrassed of it.
They're patriotic,
if you will.
They're patriotic to Iran?
Yeah, they're more patriotic, and they're always thinking in terms of being Zoroastrians. I'm not saying they're... You know, covenant family. It's almost impossible to get one to become covenant family. But all they know is they were forced into Islam, you know, through the sword. You know, there's all kinds of stories out there. And they just don't really want to have anything to do with it. And the 10 or 15% that are religious Muslims over there just abuse the hell out of the rest of them. They all know that.
Now, there was also, for years, there was, under military dictatorships, there was a secular strain in Turkey that has essentially been imprisoned and terrorized into submission. And so there was a period of time where you were a Turkish Muslim, a hypocrite, really, according to the Quran, could integrate into the West, but... None of that is true anymore. Anyway, what Iyawa says is that he's going to wash all of them away, and the Christians, of course, and the secular humanists along with them. And he's doing it so that he can establish a home for restoration, for settling down spiritually to approach the land with his hand. And then it says here, by militants on foot, they will be trampled. So before he washes it all away, he's telling... all who will listen, that the very jihadists that are being brought into Europe and the United States, they're going to trample their host down.
They're the flood.
Yeah. They are the flood.
Yeah, he they're talks about a great roaring in all these, in the wealthy countries. Mm-hmm. He said it'll be like a giant roaring wave. Yeah.
Well, isn't that the same description when they come from the sea and they come back to attack Israel?
Yes.
And it described the same way with the waters washing over and so.
Yeah, the only difference here is that he's now saying that that this tidal wave, this flood of Muslims, is arriving on foot and therefore is trampling down underfoot.
Well, that's
so when he's talking about the attack into Israel that begins the big war. Yeah, well, there it's from all. Well, it's not just from boats; it's
well,
from all around.
Boats.
But there,
it's
just flood, tidal wave. You know, roaring masses of Muslims. Here, the specific terminology is militants on foot. Haven't all of those who are running through Europe right now militants on foot. They're all exactly as he's described them. Right, one of the videos that I saw, well, I've seen two that were really interesting. One was a video of the Muslims breaking through the police. You know, the police were trying to have law and order and say, you know, if you're going to do this and you want to go to Germany, we've got to process you into Germany. You just can't run through our country. You're not welcome here. And Hungary. And they broke through. They, you know, paid no attention to the Hungarian legal system. They broke through and they trampled this huge cornfield, just left it flat. And trampling underfoot. And the other was, there was a woman cameraman and camerawoman, and she's picturing this massive flood of humanity. And they again, they decided that, you know, the police aren't going to shoot them. They're going to pay no attention to the rule of law. And they ran over the police, and they were running towards her, and she tripped two of them, and it was filmed tripping them, and she's received death threats and has had to apologize for tripping them. She says, oh, my God, I'm scared to death. You know, the police were holding them back. They overran the police. They're coming directly at me. I'm scared to death. There is fear. So it says, by militants on foot, they will be trampled. The presumptive and self-important rulers, those whose reasoning and judgment have been affected by the consumption of that which is intoxicating, those divorced from God, estranged from the covenant as a result of being religious. This would be Ephraim. So then, it will come to be that the bloom's attractiveness and appeal, its ornamentation and place of honor, will languish, wither and shrivel up, for having been played for fools. It was, first and foremost, a channel for life, enlightenment, nourishment, and healing, similar to the firstborn, Bukhutum. I mean, that was their position. And if you look at any one of these religions, you know, you take Judaism. It's an extrapolation out of the Torah into the Talmud. Claims to be Abrahamic. Christianity is takes Yosha, changes his name as he's the living witness of the Torah, and create from him a New Testament. And but they start where he is the Passover lamb. They start there, and then from there they just completely go awry.
They drop it. Yeah, they just right there. They leech
we're
start
in the right place. Yeah, we're going to be that we're Abrahamic, but we're just going to change everything. You know, we're going to feed this plant poison. We're going to prune this plant in such a way that we cut off that which is useful. And then you look at Islam, which is based almost entirely on rabbinic passages from their Talmud being twisted by Muhammad, claiming that it affirms the Torah and that it's the same God as the Torah. And even socialist secular humanism, they their story begins with the Big Bang. It begins with Mother Earth, and it's Western ideals even grew out of Yahweh's testimony. And so here's all of these religious systems all being rooted in the right place. They're just all becoming
withering away.
Withering away. Yeah, withering away. And they, you know, they were designed to be the firstborn, but no. And it's every one of these doctrines, rather than create a manifesto unique to themselves, they simply corrupted and created counterfeits of Yahweh's. That's why he says, you know, they were first and foremost to be this channel for life, the firstborn.
Well, that's where they garner their authority. Without him, there is no authority.
Yes, right. That's where. You know, Satan doesn't want to be known as Satan. Doesn't want to be worshipped as Satan. He wants to be worshipped as if he were God. So the only way to do that is to corrupt that which is God's and to replace Yahweh with himself. So it's all counterfeits and corruptions. It is Babel. So just before the summer fruit, this is the Teruah reference, just before the summer fruit, and this is that fruit, you know, because Yahweh loves to talk agricultural metaphors. It's just easy for us to understand. This is speaking of a harvest that is planted in the spring that matures during the summer, and at the end of the summer is when it is harvested. It's harvested, in other words, at Teruah. Just before the summer fruit, beneficially and relationally, he will look upon and find delight in the one who is observant and who understands. According to...
Not who obeys commands, by the way.
No.
He who obeys commands. Because that person doesn't understand.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no, it's true. The reason I had... Kirk, I don't know how many times we've gone through this passage, but I can't get away from it because every word of it either confirms what we're witnessing today or what we have come to learn over the last 10 years of days.
Well, as y'all started off with all the scientific evidence, which is overwhelmingly powerful to especially a more educated populace is exposed to it, these prophecies should resonate with everyone. I mean, because this is too profound, and when you put them in chronological order, my gosh.
You know what I found, though, is that there is something more valuable than the prophecies.
Mm-hmm.
And that is with every prophecy, Yahweh intertwines a guidance. He says, you know, if you do this, this will be the consequence. If you do this, this will be the result. And so this is no exception. He is telling us who's going to be trampled down, who's going to be washed away. He's telling us why they're going to be washed away, how we got into this fix. He's giving us a warning in advance. You know, you put your plug in that, your finger in that outlet, you're going to get shocked, and it's going to kill you. But if you... don't do that. If you listen to what I have to say, if you're inflexible regarding my guidance, if you pay attention, if you're observant and you come to understand, then it's going to turn out really well for you. Because
can I
care for you? Yeah.
Tell you a little story from today. I got on a woman's posting. She'd been asking me a couple questions, and I went and read some of her wall, and she was in the book of Enoch, okay, and this other guy that was misleading her, talking about demons are the source of babies being aborted. I said the book of Enoch, it was written under the pseudonym Enoch. That's clearly stated. I said, two, because there is no prophecy in Enoch, there is no verifiable prophecy. Anyway,
right.
I mean, there's this incredible story of, you know, elephants or something coming out of donkeys and giraffes. Nothing that's verifiable of anything, just kind of a religious rant type of thing.
One chance in a million that Enoch is...
There's no 450-foot tall guys that were ever walking around or anything else. So anyway, at the conclusion of it, the guy jumps in and right away, very accusatory, instead of listening to what I had to present to him, said, so are you for or against abortion? And I just laid down Hosha. I said, I'm going to be real honest with you. I don't have the time to care one way or another, because I'm assuming the people that are having their children aborted are people that Yahweh does not know, and they don't know him, and he says so right here. He doesn't know their children.
Right.
You know?
Exactly right. Because you forgot.
You know what the guy's answer was? Your lack of knowledge and understanding, you know, I'm going to forget your children. He put... knowledge can be a very dangerous thing because a person loses wisdom. And I said, so I'm to take your words over Yahweh's. Let's try this again.
Yeah.
And put it right down there. Yahweh's words, not mine, right there in Hosha, that I'm going to forget you and your children. I said, so now, why should I care one way or another? I said, are you asking me, do I abort babies? No, I don't. I wouldn't. You know, that's not my bailiwick. I've got no axe to grind here, you know. But presenting Yahweh's words up against yours. And so when you got these groups of people that are continually on a rant, and this is their biggest thing, they're going to save aborted babies, they're wasting their time. That's my opinion, because that's what Yahweh's words say. And I know that sounds rough.
Yeah, Yahweh doesn't speak about abortion. He has nothing to say about abortion.
He does speak about forgetting children, though.
Yes, he does. And it is true that the overwhelming preponderance, in fact, far more than 999,999 out of every million, will simply die their mortal death, and that will be the end of it. And the likelihood of those who are being aborted being loved and cherished and nurtured into adulthood is thinking, caring, rational, moral humans is pretty slim. That doesn't mean that there isn't a chance that some child that was aborted might turn out to be a major contributor and even a covenant member, but the odds are tremendously against them. I think that abortion is a bad idea, and that adoption is a much better idea. That's Yahweh's model. Yahweh believes in adoption. But the fact of the matter is, since there is nothing you or I are ever going to do about abortion, nothing.
That's a fact. I walked out of Babylon. I have no political or legal connections. You know, that's it.
I am pro-choice. I am pro-life. And I am anti-political, and so the best thing we can do is to say that's man's fight. There is no salvation story there.
None.
If you want to pick a fight that is worth fighting.
Yeah.
Since you can make no impact whatsoever on abortion, and even if you did, it's not going to change much of anything. Why not instead pick the fight where at least one in every 1,000 people, maybe even one in every 100 people who listen, will be permanently transformed, enriched, empowered, adopted into Yahweh's family. Fight the battle worth fighting.
Yep, that was pretty much my position until he started, you know, making all these accusations. And I said, well, I'm going to take your words, which is knowledge is a bad thing.
Right.
Because you lose wisdom if you have knowledge somehow. And then I'm going to use his words, which is, it's lack of knowledge that my children are damned by. And I said, your words, his words, they don't match. We're done here.
We're done.
What are you doing?
I'm going to go with his words. And of course, his words make sense, and his words don't. His words, the opposite of what makes sense. So here is Yahweh saying that the summer fruit is harvested beneficially. That tells us, of course, we knew that Teruah is going to be the harvest. But so if you were just to look at this line independently, you say, okay, God is going to harvest those at Teruah that closely examine and carefully consider, who observe and understand his enduring and restoring witness. That's what he's going to do, and he's going to do so by grasping hold of them, our hand in the palm of his hand, lifting us up, holding us. I'm not a fan of the Greek. The Greek term that Yosha is translated using is paralambano, and it means with the hand, to grasp in the hand. So he was quoting this very passage that the fulfillment, and he was speaking of Teruah on the Mount of Olives. And so on the Mount of Olives, he's translated by this by paralambano, which is to grasp in the hand, and he's quoting this passage that those who are observant at the end of summer, which is Teruah, he's going to harvest. Apart from the whole discussion here, that is affirming of what he said in the Mount of Olives. But in context, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but in context of all of this that has gone before, it certainly sounds to me like this harvest is going to take place in the immediate proximity of Yahweh engaging in on earth in this way, and of Christianity going awry. But not that it has always been awry, but it sounds to me like this would be an indication.
Yeah, that's a non sequitur, pal.
Yeah. But that this is taking place at the very end, one of the last Teruahs possible before the tribulation. It's just how it strikes me. But it doesn't, it's not necessarily so. It's just in this context, it tells me by the end of summer. It's we're going to go into the winter of our discontent for sure. Mm-hmm. That this is really the last opportunity. And he says he swallows her up. He's speaking now of Bakurim, the firstborn children. He swallows her up, accepting and embracing her, providing her with a protective covering, which makes her one with him. So this Bakurim, firstborn children, which is in the feminine. He's swallowing us up. He's making us one with him. That's how he's harvesting us. He's making us one with him. And it says that in this day, his day, Yahweh of the spiritual envoys, he will be a beautiful and valuable crown and compass while approaching a splendid adornment which increases one's attractiveness and status as he moves towards the remnant of his family. He's describing the Teruah harvest and what he's going to do on our behalf. He's going to make us one with him.
I mean, if you think about it, he's calling us a remnant right now. A remnant.
Yeah, we are. Here we are, a remnant. Yep, we're a remnant. We're his family, and we are a remnant. So he's going to swallow us up. He's going to make us one with him. We're going to have everything that he has to offer. And he's going to do it in that day, in his day. So Yahweh only has 7 days each year on his calendar. So he's fulfilled the first four Mikrae, so he's talking about the fifth one. This is the fulfillment of Teruah. And he's going to be a valuable and a beautiful crown because we become royal while approaching with a splendid adornment which increases one's attractiveness and status. This is the garment of light as he moves towards the remnant of his family. And the approaching spirit, this is Wala Ruach, and the approaching spirit for justly resolving disputes approaches the one who presides and remains, who lives and restores, upon the means to execute judgment and provide vindication. So God is going to do this in a spiritual way. We are going to become spiritual. The set-apart spirit is the one who resolves all of our inequities with our garment of light. So I think it's all predictive of what Yahweh describes in Kara 23 when he's presenting each of the seven Mikrae. We go directly into it now, and he says, speak to the sons of Yisrael, to the children of Yisrael, saying. So this is limited to the children of Yisrael. If you don't want to be an individual who engages and endures with God, this is not for you. If you want to be an individual who engages and endures for God, then Yahweh is speaking to you. And he's speaking in first person. He says, in the seventh, on the first of the month of the renewed moon, there exists for you all a Shabbaton. So, there are seven Mikrae. There are seven days in the week. There were 7 days of creation. There is a Shabbat on the seventh day. Time flows from the time that we were expelled from the garden. It'll be 6 days before we re-enter the garden, and we will spend a 1,000-year Shabbat with Yahweh. This isn't the fifth month This isn't the 6 month. This isn't the 8 month. It isn't the 12th month. It is the 7th month. And all of the remaining of the 7 Moed Mikre are all fulfilled in the 7th month. First month, 7th month. Very important. And 7 doesn't just mean 7. It means a sworn oath and promise. It also means to rest and reflect. And, you know, you look at the basis, too, of this word, you know. BSH is the teep, that which is nurturing, the spoken word. So this is the spoken word of Yahweh, which he's presenting as nurturing, followed by the Ve'ah, the nurturing word spoken by God regarding the family. There are two ways to write Shabbat and Shabbat, both with the Ain and the LF, but with the LF, it's the power of the sacrificial lamb. You know, it's the leadership of the of Yahweh as Yosha. You know, but a powerful term in the 7th month here is Kodesh. Kodesh means to renew. The reason that Yahweh uses the term Kodesh to convey month is that the new month, each month starts when the light on the surface of the moon is renewing, when it's growing. That's the start. You know, there's a lot of people that, for some reason, I don't get it, think that the start of a month is when the light is when it's a full moon. Well, that would mean that Kodesh, the Hebrew word for renewal, and the Hebrew word for month, would describe the time when the light on the moon is going to diminish. And, you know, it's not a new moon in the sense of no reflected light. It's the time where light is beginning to grow on the surface of the moon. It's a perfect term, Kodesh, to describe when this time is. So all of the Mikrei are based upon this concept. And I know there's people that want to believe that Yahweh 6 plus 1 Shabbat really isn't 6 plus 1. It's based on four, seven, and a couple of days thrown in, and it changes. It skips, and days don't count.
And then they have this trick to use. Let me show you how this, that there's a trick here. You know, and you sit there and go, oh, my God. Six plus one. It's all perfect, and now you want to have, I guess.
2.5 days.
Six.
On average,
yeah, I don't even know how you fill that out. Is it?
Yeah. 29.5, so a day and a half.
Yeah.
So 1 to 2 days every month. 1 to 2 days every month that are not part of the week.
That's completely out of Torah. That's off the path. You know, when I run into a lunar Shabbat, I mean, they're dead. They're dead, my sister.
I think you're spending too much time in Enoch, is the lunar Shabbat. So in the 7th month, or time of renewal, on the first of the renewed moon, Kodesh, there exists, Haya, there was, there is, and there always will be for you. And this is La, Atah. And so for here can also mean, and its primary meaning is to approach. So in the 7th month, on the 1st, there is a renewal to approach, for you all to approach. A Shabbaton. The only difference between Shabbaton and Shabbat is that the Shabbaton is a day which is treated like a Shabbat, but it does not
call it owner.
It's not time to the 7th day of the week. It's just a day whenever it falls, and it can fall on the seventh day. You know, every 7 years or so, it's going to fall on the seventh day. But it's, for example, this time, depending on how precise you want to be and how you view a renewing light on the moon, whether it is before or after sunset. And in my view, it has to be not only before sunset, but you have to have enough light that it you could actually discern it before sunset. You can choose either Sunday evening, day after tomorrow, or you could choose Monday evening. I think, personally, I'm going to choose Monday evening. But Monday, last time I checked, is not the seventh day of the week. It's not. This is the seventh day of the week. It started when the sun went down. And so it's not the seventh day of the week, but it is a Shabbaton. He didn't say it's a Sabbath. He says it's a Shabbaton. And so it is a day that is we are to treat like a Shabbat. There was no reason for Yahweh to explain what it means to rest and reflect, to settle, be settled into his home, to have our disputes settled and resolved, so we can settle down with him. There's no reason for him to go and explain it, since he's already explained it, both in the creation account and immediately thereafter with the plan of 6+1 and the Shabbat. So what he does is he just uses the term and he adds own to it, so it becomes a Shabbaton. And it's, I don't know why it's complicated for folks, but all it means is treat this day, Teruah, as if it were a Shabbat, even though it most likely will
it
not.
It doesn't fall on the seventh day.
Right.
Sure. Yeah, sure. And that's the only reason that he could have for a different word.
Yeah. Which, and all that means is that if you, and it, by the way, it's only different in the Wah Noon ending. So he takes Shabbat and he adds Wah Noon. And so, Kirk, what are we adding to Shabbat with the Wah Noon that would be valuable to them?
The inherited family. The nun is the inheritance, the
right. A child born with an inheritance, right?
Sure.
It's a sperm. That's basically the law is. Someone
increasing the family.
Is increasing the family and protecting the family. So this is a Shabbat that is focused on children with an inheritance becoming part of his sheltered family. That's what the word means. Now,
and I translated mine is y'all. That's okay.
Okay, y'all. All right. Yeah. Well. Okay. It is the plural of you. You know, we don't have in the South we have a plural you. It's y'all. So y'all.
Y'all.
Correct.
Shabbaton.
If this is a Shabbaton for y'all, he says that it is a Zikaron. A Zikaron is from Zakar. Zakar means to remember. It means to memorialize. So this is a day for us to remember what it means to be part of Yahweh's family. It is a day for us to memorialize his promise to harvest his children before the terrible tribulation. So it's a memorial sign. Now, memorial sign also conveys something else that I think is really important. The fact that this day is a Zikaron. Because Zakar doesn't just mean to memorialize. And if you're going to memorialize, like the Washington Memorial, isn't that memorialize the life of and the deeds of George?
Mm-hmm. That Norman Ross, since it's represented by
right, a novelist. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's a novelist. Sure. I just like the temple to Lincoln. But to memorialize is to make a sign to draw people's attention to convey the life and testimony of someone. And of course, what we're memorializing here is the life and testimony of Yahweh. So it's a memorial sign. But Zakar means more than to remember. And you can't remember unless you know it. So I'm going to side with Yahweh and Larry here. Knowledge is helpful here because you can't remember that which you never knew. So knowing is important. Remembering which you know is simply the transfer of short-term memory to long-term memory, and then the prioritization of what you've come to know. So he wants you to remember this day and to memorialize it. But Zakar, you know what the primary meaning of Zakar is?
It cuts a path to something, is to remember, recall, inherit.
I always thought remember was the primary meaning. That was my thing.
Yeah, the root of Zakar is to be born.
Huh.
It's a male child. You know, he's been talking about Bukhurim, which is feminine and Hebrew. And the reason Bukhurim is feminine, he explained it all over the place there, which is that we are become firstborn children into Yahweh's family the same way Yosef became the first of the firstborn children. His soul was enveloped in the set apart spirit. So Bukhurim is feminine because the means to the adornment and the empowerment and this whole process is the set apart spirit. This now is masculine. Zakar is the means to be a child. It's a male child, but it's a child. So
yeah.
He's talking about that Shabbaton. This Shabbaton of Teruah is all about being born. Being a child with an inheritance. That is what we're remembering, that we're being born into, becoming a child of God, born into his covenant family.
Can I digress back here just for a moment to Yashayah?
Yeah.
You know, at the end of this, where he's talking about this summer fruit that's being harvested, okay? He says, according to her, they were bearing witness. And again, you know, this is what we're doing, and this is why Teruah is trumpets, because we're out here trumpeting the words. I mean, when nobody else will. Why they won't, I have no idea. It's the greatest pleasure in my life. I don't know why they won't.
Yeah. What we are memorializing, what we're remembering, what we're inheriting, is this inheritance that we have as children born into Yahweh's family. That's the whole purpose of Teruah. And he says, in the seventh month, on the first day of the renewed moon, for you all to approach a Shabbaton, a special day set apart to rest and reflect on the Yahweh's promises. The memorial sign and the mental reminder of an inheritance rite. Teruah. A cleansing and set apart invitation to be called out and to meet. So, it's pretty... you know, what is it that we're talking about? You're talking about, Larry, that the greatest joy in your life is to share this. What we're sharing is that we've been invited to be called out and meet with God. That's what true
is. That's a huge deal. Yeah, it's huge.
Sure.
Go ahead, Kirk.
No, I was just going to say before you get to Teruah, I didn't want to change the flow, but Zakar, you know, starts out with that first letter, which is a plow that cuts a path towards something. It's also nourishment. Of course, we associate plows and things with food and nourishment as well, and words. And then it's the number seven. And then when I hear cut, I'm also thinking about the family identified by circumcision. I mean, it's just all over it. as far as meaning. So,
And it's this whole day is set apart. You know, it's your Yahweh has drawn a cut a line in the sand, and you're on one side or the other. And he loves the agricultural metaphors, because when you cut the ground with a plow and you turn it over, you make it susceptible to a you make it such that the soil can is aerated, the soil is receptive to water, the soil is receptive to seeds and to nourishment. The weeds are turned over, so the weeds become a less of a factor. And you know, it's that cutting and plowing a field that makes the field receptive to seeds, which will take root and grow. So Yahweh has prepared us to grow, to flourish, plowing the field.
You know, there's something that's always amazed me about Teruah here, beyond the corruption of Rosh Hashanah, okay, and the Temple of Marduk and all that. And it's there's so many people out here wandering around from essentially what is weak-ass website to next weak-ass website to next, which is maybe worse than that. And they are often thinking that Teruah was fulfilled with the birth of Yahusha. What part of the Torah did you miss there, boob?
Wow.
You know, I mean, what not only that, you would have the fulfillment out of order. You know, you'd be fulfilling Teruah before you fulfill Pesach. You know, and you sit there and you wonder about the logic of people. Do you think it's the fluoride in the water? What do you
think? I guess
it's the third rail.
Too much inebriation. You know, what's so amazing about all of that is the realization that Sukkah means to camp out with God. You pitch your Jerusalem to camp out with God, and you can't figure out that God camping out with man is the dress rehearsal to the fulfillment of Sukkah, when ultimately those of us who are part of his covenant family will camp out with him on earth for 1,000 years before we camp out with him for all eternity. And you can't make, even Yahukon, I mean, the disciples were not the smartest guys in all of human history. Yahukon got it. He said he came and he tabernacled with us.
Sukkahed with us.
Yeah, he sukkahed with us. Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'm not the brightest guy either, because I overlooked that foreshadowing, believe it or not, because I was only looking at Torah. But the witness writing certainly
certainly
nail that down. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious that each of the seven Moed Mikra have a dress rehearsal, a time.
Teruah is Lot.
Right. Yeah. Teruah is Lot. Yeah, absolutely. And I think to some degree so is the story of Enoch, the flood with Noah. He's taking his children out of and away from an extraordinarily corrupt world before he destroys that world. So if you look at Teruah, we're being taken out of this world before he washes it clean.
Yeah, and standing grain, physically grain.
Right.
Yeah, so these people are alive. They're not going to face a physical death, at least not then. You know?
So I don't think there's any difference between Lot and his family from Sodom, Noah and his family from the corrupt, religiously and politically corrupt and vicious earth that was washed clean. Of course, Sodom was fire and brimstone, and here's Yahweh saying he is going to wash away all vestiges of religion and politics. And but before he does it, he, just like he did with Noah, just like he did with Lot and his family, he's going to take his children out. So, yeah, there's a dress rehearsal for all of these that that help us understand the main event.
And, yeah, and they and all these mikra are fulfilled in order. In
on
order.
The right day. Yes.
Yeah.
In order on the right day. And all but one is fulfilled in not just a Yovel year, but a one of those millennial markers, you know, where one day is like 1,000 days. So he's got, you know, one day is the describes each of the seven Moed Mikra. There's only one, by the way, Moed Mikra that's on the first day of the month. That is Teruah. And so the one that's on the first day of the month is the only one that is not fulfilled during one of the 40 Yobel markers. You know, that it was year 4,000 Yah that...
Or the taint.
Right, Yosha fulfilled the first four. So the first four were fulfilled in year 4,000 Yah. And the last
only one
two,
that's not is Teruah. That's it.
Right.
The rest.
Yeah, the last two will be fulfilled in year 6,000 Yah.
Yeah, which is 2,033. And let me tell you, I've pondered that and pondered that. Could you be off a year or two?
Yeah.
That's, you know, 2,033 is the only one when Sukkah starts on a natural Shabbat. In
right.
that whole area, front and back.
Right, right. And it has
so,
to. It has to.
Yeah.
Did he tell us it has
yeah.
to? No.
No, but that would be perfect.
Yeah, is he perfect? And did he plan this thing out? Yes. So... Yeah, it's the likelihood.
It's going to be on Thursday, folks. I can tell you that.
And 33 CE is so well established through the prophecy of Daniel, and it's the only year within five either way where Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday fall, so that Pesach. Begins such that that on Friday night that Pesach is ending, so that it was a Thursday beginning of Pesach with a Friday night beginning of Matzah. So that Matzah, which is the Shabbaton, it fell on the most important day on the calendar, fell on a natural Shabbat in 33 CE, year 4,000 Yah. And, of course, it's exactly 1,000
so
years.
So Matzah falls again on a natural
right.
Shabbat. That
right,
year.
Yeah. Matzah fell on a natural Shabbat, which it had to fall. And, you know, the eyewitness accounts tell us that it fell on a natural
no,
Shabbat.
No, no, no. I knew that. I knew that. Yeah. But I did not know in 2003 it does the same pattern. That
yeah, same pattern.
See, that's 2033
and 33 is exactly the same pattern where the day that needs to be the natural Shabbat
yeah,
is.
It would be, wouldn't it? Of course. Of yeah. course.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
because in 33 it's exactly 40 Yovel later. Yeah.
Right. And it's not a coincidence that we know for certain that the cornerstone of the of Yahweh's first home, temple, on the Temple Mount, on Mount Moriah, was established by Dodd in 967 BCE. 967 BCE to 33 CE is exactly 1,000 years. And so you're dealing with Abraham and Yishak on Mount Moriah, and that was 1968 BCE, at 40 Yovel between the two. And, you know, 1,000 years before that, that's when the Berkel crater occurred. We had the flood up the Tigris and Euphrates River all the way up to the Black Sea. And 1,000 years before that is when Adam and Chawa were booted out of the garden. It's the timeline is well established. And so, you know, I had a friend that probably listened to the program, you know, wrote me a letter and said, you know, there's the book that's been written by one of his clients that says next year, he's saying the same thing that the Pope is saying, that next year is a Jubilee year. And, you know, my reaction, he said, what do you have to say about
it? And I said,
well, if you're talking about Jubilees, then you're lost. And if you think that...
right away, yeah.
Right. And if you think that 2016 is an important year, then you just do not know what the Torah says.
It's 2015 now, okay?
Yeah.
The great event in 2015.
Yeah, well, it's better be done. 2015 is meaningless. 2016 is meaningless. And so, what I said, this person wrote back and said, "Listen, the records were lost, and because the records have been lost, no one really knows. Even though they're saying it's 2016, but if you disagree with them, the records are lost, and no one knows." And so I wrote back and said, "What they're saying is." That the Jubilee, let's forget the fact for a moment, there is no Jubilee, it's a Yobel. That they're saying that the Yobel was established by the rabbis, and that the time was kept by the rabbis, and because the rabbinical records are lost, we don't know when it is because it was a rabbinical thing. And last time I checked, the Yobel was presented in the heart of the Torah. It's presented and discussed in great detail in the 25th chapter of Korah, right in the heart of the Torah. And Yahweh is the one that established the timing of it. And so what this guy is saying, he can pick 2016 because it was a rabbinical thing and their timing is lost. And I'm saying, come on. I mean, don't you know what happened in 33? Or the 33 was year 4000 Yah, and that Yah establishes the Yobel, and the rabbinic records are meaningless?
Is there such a thing as a rabbi that Yah would like?
No.
Okay. Well, you listen to rabbis.
Yeah. And, you know, why do you think, speaking of rabbis, why do you think that Rabbi Akiva chose Bar Kokhba and announced that he was the Masayach in 133 CE?
I know why.
Same reason. Yeah.
Yeah.
He knew that the time was up.
Right. And then it was a Yobel year.
None of it was real.
Yobel.
And he missed it by 100 years.
Right. Well, yeah. And he knew that it was a Yobel year in 133. It's the last Yobel year celebrated in Yisrael. And, of course, the Bar Kokhba, son of a star, celebration of the fall of Masayach in the Yobel year led to the destruction of Israel and the destruction of the records. But we know that was 133 because it was between 133 and 135 that Yehuda was obliterated.
You can sell it if you have something attached close.
Gosh.
Or you got to be as close to sell it as anyway.
Well, no, I think he was losing it. He was losing it. He knew. That's why he did it.
So that would mean, since if you're thinking it through, that since the Yobel is the time of settling all debts and returning the land to its rightful owner, which would be to Yahweh, that's the year that Yahweh is going to return the land, all of the earth, to himself, returning it back to the conditions it found in the Garden of Eden. And that he's going to forgive all debts, going to reconcile his relationship with his children, and he's going to free his children. That means that if you're saying that 2016 is the Yobel year, then you are proclaiming that's when he's going to return. There was no tribulation. I mean, there was no tribulation. The whole tribulation thing was a farce. The Magog War was he missed on that, and he's coming back next year.
Everything's wrong. Everything's wrong. Yeah, exactly. You know, I've had people tell
me... And nothing happened in 33. It must have happened in 16.
Yeah, right. And I've got people telling me, and why is it, by the way? And I have to say, why do they keep going back to Daniel in the 70 weeks?
Well, that
was a prophecy about when Yahushua would ride into Jerusalem.
4 days before Pesach.
Yeah, what do they think that that's got to do with his return?
Yeah, and they're citing for a future event. The 70 weeks is said that it applies to somehow to 2016. You just said, are you an idiot? I mean, what part of...
Hey, let me tell you about idiots. I had one on my page telling me we're in the fourth seal. I'm going, what? What happened? Did the Dow Jones drop 100 points? I think it gets a little worse than all that.
Right. You know what's amazing about this whole thing is that didn't Gabriel tell Daniel that he should start counting when there is the decree to return to Jerusalem? And didn't that decree occur in 444 BCE? And therefore, why would you count from any other day than from 444 BCE? I mean, I don't get it.
I have no idea. I have no idea. I'm lost here. I'm thinking that that's why we can have such...
444 BCE, you come to 4 days before Pesach, and you're 4,000 years or 33 CE.
I know.
The Torah is easy to understand for those who are open-minded.
Well, you're that math, you know, I don't quite understand it. I almost get it, and you've explained it to me three times. So, obviously, I've got a mental block here. But it doesn't matter. I understand what it is to the day and all that, and that's what's important. But I have to tell you, I think that the reason that they have the demented maniacs in charge everywhere in the world today is because people have lost the ability to think.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, almost as a collective, completely. There are very few thoughtful people, and I mean in any serious way.
Yeah.
You know, I think some of the things you've been saying, I recognize them as different prophecy preachers that are on TV, because I listened to them 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And they're still selling the same book, saying the same thing. So that's where they're getting it. They just listen to them and they believe them, so they repeat it probably to you.
Yeah. Well,
really?
It's not original thought. That's been floating around, a lot of that stuff.
But, you know, the timing of the Daniel prophecy, there's only two challenges in trying to unravel it. There's only two. One is, when was the 20th year of the king? And if you don't recognize, if you don't do your homework and look at how he came into power and how he killed his brother and how there, you know, was a viceroy that tried to kill him. And, you know, if you don't read the history, you'll be off by 1 year. You'll choose 445 BCE versus 444. But
okay,
to be precise, it's 444 BCE. And in the Masiyah chapter of Yada Yah, I go through the history of the intrigue that was taking place in Babylon at the time. And so there is the history, and Yahweh establishes the day on his calendar that you begin to count. So that's the first challenge, is it does take some knowledge. Since he establishes it based on a historical date with the 20th year of a king that is known to us, we have to look at history to know what that date is.
He puts it there for a reason.
Right, he gave it to us for a reason, so we've got to do the research. The second is that when he's talking about years, is he talking about a solar year or what's called a prophetic year? You know,
that's where I get lost. That's where I get lost, to be honest.
And the difference is that a prophetic year is the year that Yahweh establishes in the story of the flood, where he is dealing with a 360-day year. And that's a prophetic year, and he establishes that in the story of Noah. And what you have to do is you do all the math based upon a 360-day year. So you multiply all that out, but then to get it to sync with our calendar, you then have to deal with 365 and a quarter days. And when you do that math, you end up 4 days before Passover in 33 CE, which is year 4000 Yom. That's how you, when the Passover lamb comes from Bethlehem and into the home.
That's what I was missing.
360. That's how you get through the math. And if you don't do it as a 360 day year, you'd end up with him coming into Jerusalem to be cut off, but not for himself, because you're dealing with about 500 years. So it's 500 years times the difference in five and a quarter days. So that's you're dealing with him coming in a year and a half later. So it's not near Passover, so it doesn't sink, and it's in 34, and there's are 35, and there's just no chance that it occurred then.
It has to come and sink with Peacock.
Yeah.
Thing too with these 70 weekers that are always going to this being the return, the end of the Battle of Armageddon. I don't understand what they're doing, because the 70 weeks was definitely to get the suffering servant to Jerusalem. I mean, that was it. That's what it was about.
Right.
I mean, I could read that. That's exactly what it was about. Somehow they go to this 70 weeks thing and go, Daniel, in the 70 weeks. And then they start.
And then you've got your 2 days that are presented, the 2 days that are presented in Hosea that get you from Yoda,
33 to 2000.
Right. Those are the 2 days for the.
And the third day, I'll be with you.
The third day, I'll be with you, which is the camping out of Sukkah. And Shavua is the only one of the seven that doesn't fall on one of these Yobel years, and it occurs in all likelihood 7 years before the Yobel of 2033, or year 6000 on Yahweh's calendar. And you know what, guys, the thing...
You know, with all this talking, let me say this to you guys.
Yeah.
With all this talking about Teruah, and as much as I've been over Teruah, and as much as I love Teruah,
Teruah. Yeah,
it's
one of my favorites.
Exciting. It's so exciting, okay?
Yeah.
The thing that really gets me is no matter who you are, it's going to be a surprise when he shows up. Do you understand that? I mean, I'm going to be shocked to the core. Yeah. I really will be shocked.
Yeah.
You're going to be happily
shocked, but I'm going to be shocked.
It's going to be an experience.
It's going to be an experience beyond what we can't even imagine in terms of.
I've never met a supernatural individual.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I know him. I've read all about him.
Hit the lottery.
Scratched the surface.
But we are one billionth of what we are going to be in just that instance. But you know, if Teruah meant nothing more to you than memorializing the fact that it's a day that is set apart, that you're invited to be called out and meet with Yahweh, that's enough, isn't it?
That's enough.
Invitation to be called out and meet. Isn't that enough?
But yes, it is. Once you have understanding, it's so much more.
Right.
That's why we understand foreshadowings, we understand fulfillments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a big thing. How many people do you think in the world understand the foreshadowings and then the fulfillments?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that as we were just talking, Larry. And it is astonishing to me that this picture that Yahweh has painted is so clear, so majestic, so powerful, so integrated, so reinforced. Everything. 6 + 1 = 7. And every important date following the plan of the Yobel and of the Mikre and it's all based upon the Shabbat and of Yahweh's plan of 6 + 1 = 7, of man plus God equals his idea of perfection, of us returning to the very place we started in Eden. It's all so clear, and it's all fits together so beautifully. Why in the world are there only a few thousand of us amongst billions?
Do you think there's that many
that have embraced the truth?
Oh, do you think there's that many that truly understand that? I mean, these mikra are there for the purposes of understanding. These
right.
mikra have a reason. These mikra have a foreshadowings, and then in addition, they have a completion. They have a fulfillment. I don't think there's 3,000 people in the world that know that. There might be. I mean, I may be way off.
I am quite confident there are 1,000. Beyond that.
Well, that's a long way from three. You know. I'm just saying it's pretty sparse out there. And it's shocking to me, and quite frankly, myself and many others would never have gotten to this. I don't know how you feel about it, Kirk, but never have gotten to this had Yada Yah not been written.
No, he had to dig out for me. I mean, I've said that many times, and he knows.
And Yada Yah would never have been written if Yahweh hadn't written what Yada Yah is written to convey. And it's all there. It's just,
well, look,
and
look,
it all
look
fits
how
together
much,
so beautifully.
But look how much we've changed in the last month.
Pardon me?
What did you say, Kirk?
No, I was just going to say, look how much we've gained in the last, I'd say, 4 to 6 weeks with Roy and you and William, and I think it was at Frank
or
Henry or somebody, and it just went on and on. After we'd find a little morsel, and then we'd dig, we'd play with it and read it some more and study and say, my gosh, look at that.
Yeah, oh, no, I'm not saying we don't grow exponentially.
Yeah.
I just added to the Teruah note that last passage in Yasha Yah.
Right.
I mean, because
I had no idea what
these
there.
Are. Yeah,
so, you know,
these are people being.
I received a note from one of my favorite people saying, you know, would you devote the next few programs to Teruah? And my response was, you know, it was my intent to do so, but I don't know if you noticed, but our Yasha Yah 28 presentation that was designed to expose and condemn the world as it exists today ended up not only being prophetic in terms of the Muslims migrating into Europe and what the consequence of that's going to be, but it was prophetic regarding Teruah.
I think it's a reason for Teruah.
Yeah, it's the reason for Teruah. So
I want to say something too. I want to say something too about those Muslims coming in. If they're hijab wearing, they're dead.
Right.
I mean, they're hopeless. If they're not, they're secular and they're running. But either way, it won't matter. And here's why it doesn't matter. And I'm sure you know this. In an Islamic society, and I don't care if it's an Islamic neighborhood. You know, ask the people in London, Stan. The religious people will get the hold of it because they will organize in their mosques. And even if it's a Muslim that doesn't care one way or another, they're going to fall right in line. And that's what's going to happen. That's just the way it works.
The great hope is that Saudi Arabia announced today. First, the Pope announced today that all Catholics should take in a Muslim family.
I saw that a couple days ago. Yeah.
And then Saudi Arabia announced that rather than take in these Muslim refugees, they're going to build thousands of mosques for them in Europe.
Wherever they are. Yeah.
But that's actually encouraging because you hear what happened at the Grand Mosque in Mecca today.
Oh yeah, the big fell down and killed a bunch of people.
Yeah, the crane teetered over. Somebody was learning about gravity there. Killed 107. I mean, I just laugh because Islam is so vicious, so vile. It means that the host of Ebola have been eradicated, but 107 super religious Muslims out there prancing around the rock pile known as the Kaaba were killed by the crane when it gave in to gravity.
hey, baby, it was Allah's will, you know.
You know, there was a thing you brought up on the second hour today with IQ, which I was thinking about because I grew up with everybody in my family worked and wanted to work and loved their jobs and were into their fields, and I did too. And I mean, I couldn't wait to get out of school. I hated school. I mean, I did well.
Yeah, I wanted to work too. I got tired.
I wanted to get out and do something, you know.
I like
it. And I don't think a young man who grows up when his father doesn't work and his grandfather doesn't work and his uncles don't work could ever assimilate into and become a productive. I'm not saying everyone, but the percentages have to be almost infinitesimal.
They'd have to go to Tom Hendricks' school. They'd have to go to Tom Hendricks' class for about 10 years.
You know, I didn't go with it this morning, and what I wanted to do, but I just thought it would be too much with IQ. What I wanted to do is because IQ made the point that the Muslims don't work, and so I went back to the Hadith and the Quran, and I mentioned that unlike the Torah, which begins the first instruction to man is that you're going to work, and that the whole Shabbat is established with 6 days of work following by a day of rest, and all of Yahweh's metaphors are agricultural metaphors where you're tilling the ground you're working, that Yahweh describes work as a good thing because the covenant is not free. Covenant's not free. And it's this myth of Christianity that your salvation is a free gift, that you don't do anything for it. That's not true. If you want to know God, you're going to work at it. If you want to be part of the covenant, you're going to have to engage.
You've got to get into his terms and conditions to understand him.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to get into words like Shamar and Torah to understand he's not a monster.
Correct.
I mean,
you have to work
the biggest
connections.
Fight. Yeah, and the biggest fight we have is always the same thing. Yahweh is not a religious deity. Yahweh wants no religion tied to him. How do I know it? Well, he said it. And
he
said,
doesn't want faith either. He wants you to work at coming to observe so
knowledge.
That you know, and then to contemplate, be in, make connections so that you understand. So you can exercise your free will, and then your nesama, and make an enlightened and appropriate moral decision regarding what he is offering.
You know, I don't understand it. I'm at a point here where no matter what you throw at somebody, look, he says right there in Dabarim, not to imitate any, all of them, none of them, the disgusting religious ways of the Gentiles.
Right.
Go through some of those. Do they pray?
Yeah,
they're praying all the time.
How about
do
Sunday?
They praise God? Yeah, they're praising God all the time.
Are they worshiping?
We sit,
yes.
Oh, yeah. And we sit there and
Easter.
Look.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the religious
Trinity.
Holidays. And
Trinity.
Yeah.
All Hallows.
You know.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. You could be into Shintoism bowing. You know, you could be into
Babel.
Buddhism bowing. Right?
Well, Larry, I don't know if you were on your deathbed last week, but we spent a better part of an hour talking about the connections to Babel. Babel is the Hebrew word.
Oh yeah,
Babel.
No, I did. I listened to the show.
Yeah.
You're talking about Babel and Babel and the root word. Not even to forget Biblos.
Babel and Bible is the same word. Yeah, and it means to confuse. And that Babel means ba in and with. Bell. So it's with and in the Lord.
The Lord. Yeah.
Right. So Bible, Babel,
confusion,
in and with the Lord, where the Lord is the whore of Babel, the whore of Babylon, Satan.
That's just horrible.
Oh, it's just horrible. And it's
and run around with a book named Holy Bible to top it off.
Right.
Holy!
Babel.
The most important sun festival of the Eastern sun god Krishna. Holy.
Right.
Oh, how lovely.
Yeah.
How
lovely. And then the constellation of Taurus the bull, the principal pagan symbol, the golden calf, the Apis bull of the pharaohs in Egypt. It's the winged bull was on the entrances of the gates to Babylon. And that's Easter.
Can I tell you a real quick story? You'll like it. I know Larry doesn't play golf, but you play golf.
Yeah.
This is for Larry, I think. I appreciate it as a teacher. You know, he spent most of it, after Tommy Armour won every tournament there was, retired and became a teacher. And he said there was two types, and I read his book 100 times probably. In his book, he said two types of people come to him. One of them comes, and they are inquisitive and want to know, and he'll tell them things, and they'll put it to work, and they'll ask questions, but they're inquisitive. They want to know what, explain it to me. He said there's another person that comes there and wants to tell him, one of the greatest champions of his time, how to teach him. He says those people I cut loose right away.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the same type of person. I'm sure the ones who come to you.
Well, the prayer without ceasing, the people that want to tell God what they want done.
Yeah.
You know,
he just doesn't. He walks away from them, you know.
Right.
Just tell me you guys enjoyed my prayer. And that was beautiful.
Oh,
I listened to it myself. I was sick that night down there, so I was stumbling all over. But I got to tell you, I re-listened to it because
it's funny.
It was put on YouTube.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was laughable. I had myself laughing at that one.
Yeah.
It was so beautiful. It was
this whole
perfect
idea that the Christian prayer was just to tell God all the things we want Him to do. Why not? Why don't we shut up and we listen to all the things He wants to do?
Well, but see, as a master salesman, and I can say I'm that. I know you are that. We know that 60% of a conversation is listening. I could listen while I was talking. I could listen by just simply watching movement.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's
I
what
I sold by listening to what my customer wanted.
Yeah, boy, that's tough.
Yeah. And when you're selling, you're spending 5% of your mental processing capability thinking about what you're going to say, and 95% reading the person that you're talking to.
Oh, yes.
95%.
Now you better
you're looking at every subtle thing that from their expression to their tone of their voice to the way they're sitting, everything about them, everything surrounding them, you're listening, you're observing. And that's where you spend your time. If you want to be an effective salesman, you're going to be an extraordinarily good listener and observer.
And that's communication, though. That's
right.
When you're at your most effective communication. And so why would anybody think, if they did not seriously chew that cud, really look at those words and really think about what they mean in terms of relationship, you know, they've lost already, because you know we were in some rather long running discussion with some boob that came off with obey and command right out of the box. Remember that in an email here recently?
Yeah, sure.
And the guy was just a moron. He didn't listen to anything. He had developed concepts in his mind that were not true of us. They are not true of Yahweh's words, and he wouldn't listen. And when I take somebody and I show them, you know, Dode showed us that there's how they put praise in. Remember, he said, seven is the promise.
They've got,
I praise you seven times a day. The word isn't even there. I mean, they just put it in there, you know.
Right.
And people eat it up. They eat it up.
Yeah, there's a notion that a God that would create the universe and a being in that universe to tell him how wonderful he is and to worship him, that's not a being that I ever want to know.
Well, that's not a being that's as powerful or as bright You know,
that's something that's incredibly insecure. I've been around insecure people, and man, there is no worse cancer on this planet than an insecure person. If the creator of the universe needs to be told by his creation how wonderful he is, then you don't want to know him.
No. This would be a very, very dangerous creator. This would be Stalin on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
And, right.
You know,
and it would never be satiated with being told how wonderful he is. No.
I'll tell you a story here.
By the way, Yahweh knows he's wonderful. He knows. I know it. You know it. He knows.
Yeah. I don't think he cares one way or another about it, to be honest with you. I really don't.
There are some things he cares about, being dependable, being steadfast, being reliable, honoring his promises, you know, those kind of things. That means a lot to him.
Well, I think he also knows that the people that listen to him realize he's all that and a bag of chips.
He's praiseworthy, no question, but he's just not interested in praise.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, if I tell somebody they did this wonderful thing for me, that's not necessarily praise, that's just honesty.
Family. If it's, let's say that your father did something really good for you, you're not going to worship him. You're not going to praise him. You're going to acknowledge that, hey, that was an all right thing to do. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're going to thank him.
Sure. Yeah. It was a gentlemanly.
There's a story. I don't know. There's a lot of big time music studios. Have you guys ever heard of Muscle Shoals?
Alabama.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. One of the astounding things that I found about Muscle Shoals was just a guy that came from such a dirt poor, poverty stricken background to do what he did. And then these swampers, as they called them, these guys that were backup bands for so many number one hits, I had no idea. They said they worked, they talked about any number of people they worked with, whether it was Dylan or whether it was the Rolling Stones or, any number of big-time bands. But the guy said, we had a 10-year run with, and this is somebody I had always considered to be one of the better writers and artists and singers in the United States, Bob Seger. He said, with Bob Seger. And he said, the interesting thing about Seger is that he had no ego. Now, imagine Yahweh.
Wow. The ultimate songwriter.
Well, the ultimate everything. How do you have to brag,
Right.
Well, I'll tell you one thing he does like us to do, I believe, my take on the reason we're celebrating Teruah, is it is the most magnificent plan, the seven-step plan. No one could conceive that. We don't have the brains, collective brains or otherwise. I don't care how smart everybody is out there. They couldn't come up with it as a better plan,
right,
a more fair plan, a more honest plan.
Right.
And he is so magnificent, and he is proud of his plan. I know he likes his plan.
He is proud of it.
Yeah.
Proud of his name, proud of his plan.
Somebody asked me, why do you do it? Why do you celebrate that? And he said, because it's one of the 7 days of the year when you can actually just study how magnificent it is. Just spend the whole day just thinking about how wonderful it is.
And share it and let it ooze out of you, right? Now, by the way, when I was talking about salvation isn't free, you've got to work for it. Relationship with God's not free, you've got to work for it. It needs to be reinforced that work is not a bad thing. It's not a burden. It has tremendous rewards. The harder you work for something, the more you enjoy the result, the more the result means something to you. The fact that it's hard to translate is the reward. That's why it's so rewarding when you get it and you learn something from it. It's work is not a negative thing. It's a very positive thing. I've gotten now your character.
Yeah, you know what? I've gotten to do something that I hadn't. I'm really getting more comfortable as I translate, where I just you just take a verse that you might say we're going to go talk about that, in the, or you mention it, and I'll go translate it. I might spend several hours on it because I'm slow, but I'll go to all different books and everything. And but a lot of these things you've already translated, and I know I've read them somewhere, but I couldn't recite them per se. But when I go back and look at them, I'm really getting fairly good at it, where I see why you chose what you chose, and grammatically and things like that. And most of the time, I'm choosing pretty close to the same thing, and it's you do get better. I mean, I thought I'm never going to figure this stuff out, but
you do get better, and you learn. After a while, you develop an understanding of the vocabulary so that you look at things and you see the connections just because.
Yeah.
You, like the other day when we were talking about Babel, and I was thinking, wait a minute, Babel is simply Ba and Baal. And so it's with and in Baal, you know, with and in the Lord. Wow. You know, so you just... After a while, the vocabulary resonates.
It becomes second nature.
Becomes second nature, and then you make the connection. So, yeah, I'm in agreement with you that there. Now that
that's good work.
Becomes easy because, like, translating Yashaya, so much of the vocabulary that is used in Yashaya is not used elsewhere. Very specific terms, and rather than repeating the same terms over and over, he'll use four or five different words, for example, for intoxication. And so you're really duty bound to figure out the nuances between them. And he'll use a word like flood that can speak both of the religious the jihadists that are flooding into Europe, and also him using a flood to wash them away.
Well, the one you just quoted, earlier in the show, I think there's four different versions of flood in there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's flood, it's pouring down rain, a hailstorm.
Right.
I mean, it's the whole. You know, it's like, and I did the same thing. I went back and did all the, you know, looked them all up, and I'm going, well, didn't you say that? And then you say, why did you say it differently?
Right, why did you say it differently? And if you're not questioning why he said it differently, then you're not observing. That's how you make the connections. That's how you observe. Why did he use two different words for intoxication? Why did he go from initially speaking of Ephraim, you know, and a warning to Ephraim, and yet he doesn't define who Ephraim is in the fact that this prophecy is Ephraim. Ephraim has been, is dead.
For long, many
right. So you see, you've got to go and make the connections. It's so the whole benefit is investing the time to think about what's being conveyed and what it means. Why did he switch from being blunt about the leadership of Ephraim being intoxicated to then being subtle and using the metaphor of the flower? You know, what was it about Ephraim that makes him equivalent to a faded flower on a plant?
Yeah.
And so you have to think it through. That's where you learn.
Yeah.
That's the fun part.
I did 2 hours on just the word teruah and his roots, and I'm going in trumpets. So.
Oh, yeah. Well,
so it don't happen in a...
Yeah, and on Monday, we can start right there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's look at teruah and its roots. Teruah is a wonderful word. Boy, there are so many insights is what the word means.
Mm-hmm. So I think the primary meaning are those trumpeting his words, though. That's what I think in this case.
Through a ram's horn. You know, we're talking about, you know, Aleph, the first letter is the ram's horn. It's the sacrificial lamb of Yahweh. It's the ram that protects his flock and won't accept a rival. You know, It's the blowing of our soul, our life energy, into the air, which then equates it with the spirit ruach and how it's magnified through this teruah, ram's horn trumpet. It's the instrument that was used to shout out a warning and to announce the arrival of an important message. Oh yeah, it's. I mean, if you just boil it all down to a simple thing, it's warning people that they're on the wrong path.
You're sounding an alarm.
Joy. Yeah, at the same
well,
time.
So it's shout for joy, you know.
Shout for joy. Tell them the truth.
Yeah, well, I had a friend once that's, you know, he stayed in a, he was in a construction crew, and he went out and he was yelling Yahweh's name all night, you know, and I said, I think that kind of gets away, you know, I know it says don't spare your voice, I said, but, you know, we're sharing words. I mean, I do it on FB, and I'll do a lot of it that day, and that's where I think we can be most effective, or at least I can be on that day. And so that's what I'll be doing.
Yep.
And I've got a beautiful note made on Teruah that shows fulfillment. It shows the reason.
Yep.
You know, and these are the things that people need to know. It's part of, it's the fifth step in a seven-step plan.
And this is the step that is only Yahweh's children.
Yeah.
In other words, these are the Teruah is for the beneficiaries of Pesach, Matzah, Bukkudim, and Shavuah to share what we have come to know as part of Yahweh's family and in anticipation of the day of reconciliation. And then
ultimately
with Yahweh.
Yeah, which is why Sukkah is really tied to Kippurim right there in the words. I mean, that's how Zechariah ends, basically, the battle of Mogi Down, right?
Teruah is a day for very, very, very few people. They're those who are part of the covenant to share what we know and love.
Yep.
That's the purpose of the day. So we are indeed in a very fortunate position to be able to share what it means to be part of Yahweh's family with a world that needs to hear that message. Shavuot is a wonderful holiday.
Hmm.
I'm going to answer the invitation.
Me too.
Yep.
You're kidding.
All right, fellas. Yep. All right, fellas. I'm glad you're
here. All right. Good to have you back, Larry.
Yeah,
Well, thank you, Kirk. It's been a pleasure. I do wonder how JB's doing.
I've been thinking about him the whole show. Poor guy. He is really torn up. The broken leg is bad, but he's shattered.
Provide some help to them, I don't know, but it sounds like it to me, just right off the top. I mean, I realize that's not why we're here, but we are here to help family when they need it. So.
Yeah. I think he's got lots of support. I think it's now just, it's going to take a shattered shoulder. It's going to take some very fine.
What you said last week sounded horrible.
Yeah, he shattered his shoulder. I think it's 14 breaks in his shoulder. And you know, his wife, when you have a shattered shoulder and a broken leg,
she's pregnant.
She's pregnant. I mean, he's in a really rough. That's a really rough situation.
Yep.
Yep. So,
well, listen, you guys. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Enjoy it very much. Thank you.
Good night. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night.